Okay, folks, good day. Elvin Shamrock here again. I hope you're all well. As we approach the end of Caseless Collection, today is the last day. So we're moving right along. And before I start formally, I just want to again tell you folks that the Caseless is really a major, major part of the exam. And I want to implore each and every one of you to not compromise on producing the perfect Caseless for each of you. It's all individualized, not only because you have your own patients, but also because each and every one of you have different areas of OBGYN that you're more or less comfortable to talk about. And so please make sure that you write up your Caseless in such a way that you embellish and emphasize those points you want to talk about, and minimize to the extent that you can those points you don't want to talk about. It really is important. But that aside, for those of you who are joining us for the first time today, the way this works is we have today two volunteers for the hot seat. They've submitted some cases which actually are great cases to talk about today and for the exam, for this kind of discussion. They both sent me an email of the week describing the case, and we're going to discuss them. So, and outside of that, this is completely unrehearsed. I have a rough idea of how the conversations are going to go, but nothing more than that. Let's just make sure we've got our two volunteers with us. I have muted everyone out so that we can all hear what's going on. But let's just check our volunteers. The first one is Rebecca. Rebecca, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, Rebecca.
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you so much for joining. Good, wonderful. And Nazanin, are you there? Can you hear me, Nazanin?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, wonderful. And also, thank you for joining and welcome. So let's get right on with it. Rebecca, you submitted two cases for discussion, and
yes.
You wrote me a long essay. I appreciate it. I can tell you, although you've been very, very expressive and told me what's been going on in this case, the first case, I did read it, and I saw your comments at the end. I do want you to try and present this as simply as you can, and it's not so easy, but I want you to
okay.
try and avoid spending too much time in the presentation, and I will preface everything by saying it's a great case and a case that you can really shine on if you're well prepared. So with that being said, go ahead and present the case to us, and we can check.
Okay, this is my concise version. This is a 32-year-old G1 healthy mom with a normal pregnancy course, post-date induction of labor, Cytotec to Pitocin protocol, uncomplicated labor course until the second stage when mom started pushing, baby with a zero station to one station with contractions, two plus with contractions towards the end, had a terminal D cell that never came back up, failed vacuum with pop-off times two, I did not do forceps as that's not something I'm comfortable with. And given that I work in a rural hospital, we do not have in-house OR staff. They are on a 30-minute call cycle. And given the terminal D cells that never came back up, I felt that the only thing I could do was a bedside C-section for which I consented the patient for, and she consented. She did have an epidural in place that provided anesthesia. And we performed a bedside C-section as you would expect. The infant came out and had Apgars. Let me look. In short, I only have two nurses present with me in my rural hospital, and one stayed with the mom after the baby. He was out of path and performed NPR and CPR resuscitation on the baby, for which we did get back at around 6 minutes. And around that time, the ER doctor and a local pediatrician showed up to help and take over. And I had called in a general surgeon to help me take the patient to the back to complete closure. the baby was immediately transferred to the NICU in Corpus Christi. And one thing that's very hard for me is I can't get a lot of information from a hospital I'm not associated with, but I do know from mom's reports and the reports we were able to get that the baby spent multiple weeks there and is now 9 months old, able to track with eyes, is nonverbal, but is getting there, just because they barely fail test, but otherwise the baby will slowly start meeting milestones, and ultimately we have a live mother and a live my question is that I'm so involved in this that finding out where to put things on the list and how to present it in a concise way, but and also not having exact NICU information, how that all plays into correctly presenting it into a it's written. One.
Okay.
Way to present it.
So you're done, or there's something more?
No, I was just saying, did you think that was enough information? Or be concise?
So what I'm going to do is I'm not going to answer your question. I'm going to call in Nazanin. Nazanin, question to you. And it's really important that you be totally honest, okay? We're not going to be kind, but we're going to be honest. If you tell me, and you're talking for everyone listening in, if you think that Rebecca's presentation was reasonable or not, be honest.
So I think it can be more concise. Because definitely the examiner is not going to sit, listen through that. But, I mean, I love a good story, so it was good to me. But,
I agree with you. I agree with you. There's a lot in this case, Rebecca, and it is tough to get it all out. But I think you did a good job of presenting. And what I also liked is you've shown in your presentation a confidence level and a comfort level that you were able to function under sorely adverse circumstances which you're experiencing in a rural area. And that's to your credit in a big way. So I just wanted to share that with you, and I want to come back to a few issues here. I think, and I'm a generalist. I'm not an MFM. I think your presentation was great. Okay, I think the presentation was great with only one exception. Okay, let me ask you. And Nazanin, you're going to be the referee here, okay? Rebecca, you said you put a vacuum on at 0 to +1 station. Nazanin, of putting on a... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, just for clarification, so when we started pushing, she was 0 to 1, and when the terminal decel happened with a contraction, she was at 2. She was like... turtling back and forth between 1 and 2.
Okay. So I'm very pleased this happened, because the point I want to make for everyone listening in, what just transpired now is there was a misunderstanding.
Yeah.
It might have been that Rebecca misspoke. It might have been that I misheard. But either way, there was a misunderstanding. And the point that I want to make is, this can happen in the exam. And if it does, you need to just be open and honest, just like Rebecca did now. She, in an open and honest fashion, she said, no, that's not quite what happened, and she corrected it. And that's fine. The only addition that I could have added to your correction is you could have, after correcting what you just said now, Rebecca, you could have added, no, if I would have put it on at 0 station, that really would have been a problem, because that would have been regarded as a mid or high forceps application. So you see, I'm coming back to you because I've got a concern that you place the vacuum too high. And if you understand that it's good to correct me, no, that's not what I said, but go further, one step further, and show the examiner that you understand why the examiner raised that issue, and you agree with the examiner. Does that make sense to you, Rebecca?
Yes, and you bring up an excellent point why I presented these two patients, because I am a single physician all by myself, and these two cases create such emotion inside me that I can't present them so concisely as my other cases, and I probably will misspeak or talk fast.
That's okay. Look, there are a couple of points I'm going to mention now. I don't want to spend too much time on this with everyone else listening in, but I would invite you, Rebecca, when we're done, send an email to info@examprod.com, attention Dr. Shamroff, with your telephone numbers. And tomorrow I'll contact you, and we can go into detail of how you two should write this up and how you should present it, because some of the details are not relevant to everyone else, okay? So we'll have a one-to-one conversation later on this week.
Okay.
But a couple of things I want to mention. So the 0 to +1 station, you've cleared up. Tell me, how many pop-offs did you have?
I had 2 pop-offs, and given that I had placed an FSC and I knew that we had no heart tones and I knew that I had no backup staff, I felt like I have a rule of 2 pop-offs only, but I also felt like I needed to move to step 2 or we were going to lose this this child.
Okay, so did you reapply the third time or not?
No.
Okay, so you applied pop-off 1, reapplied pop-off 2, pop-off 1, reapplied pop-off 2, and that was it. You did not reapply a second time. You didn't apply
correct.
A third time.
I didn't. Correct. I didn't feel like we got any.
Okay,
that's
the point I
want
to make. Okay, so I want to just emphasize this to everyone listening in. A pop-off can occur, and we discussed this a couple of months back. A pop-off can occur, and you can reapply. If you reapply after a second pop-off, although there's nothing definitive in the literature in this regard, I would say the consensus is that you shouldn't reapply after a second pop-off. With the proviso, because some of you listening in may have this, and how do you defend it? You say, you know, normally I wouldn't reply. I wouldn't reapply after the second pop-off. But in the second instance, the machine popped off because the vacuum was lost mechanically. So it wasn't a failed vacuum because the fetus was a problem. It was a failed vacuum because the machinery was a problem. So if you've got a situation where you've applied it a third time after 2 pop-offs, that's something that might help your defense. So I just wanted to share that with you, okay? The bulk of this discussion is going to revolve around doing a C-section under local anesthetic, okay? And I don't want to go through it again because we've gone through that. Actually, I think very recently we did it. But you can listen in the archives. I know virtually every one of you listening in, I know this historically, and I would expect this year will be no different. Virtually every one of you listening in is going to come to our definitive board prep course, and we will discuss this very issue at that course. Take about 20 minutes over it, but we've got you covered. So I'm not going to waste your time by going through it again now. Some of you may, by the way, have already attended our course because we did the online live Zoom course just a couple of weeks ago. So some of you may have already attended. But those who haven't, whether you're attending the hybrid or whatever, we will discuss how to do a C-section under local. So you'll be good on that. Rebecca, if you have any specific questions, again, we can discuss that later on. The fact that you've got no NICU information is not a problem. The fact that you try to get it is what counts, and that's what's important. And you did try, and that's great. I've got an interesting question for you. As I understand it, you're doing the C-section under very trying circumstances, to say the least. And you pull out a flat baby. And now you're the only one who can take care of the baby. And it took a short while before the pediatricians arrived.
Right.
How did you decide where to give your attention? To a mother who's got a laparotomy incision in her tummy with an open uterus bleeding versus a baby who's got no Apgar to speak of? How did you handle that?
Well, at that time, I assigned the more seasoned nurse to receive the baby. I was kind of giving out orders as I was getting, you know, it kind of all happened within 30 seconds or less. But I identified a nurse that I felt comfortable could start the baby resuscitation. And I had had them pull in the crash cart so that I knew I had laps in there, because I've thought about this before running my, I run an entire labor and delivery unit by myself. And so I had thought through this before, so I just kind of went back to my what
stop
I
stop there for a moment. Stop there for a moment. Stop, Rebecca. Rebecca, hold on. Nazanin, the way Rebecca just presented in the last 30 seconds, what do you think of her as a candidate? Again, be honest. If you think she's screwing up, I want you to say so. If you think she's doing great, I want you to say so. Be honest. How do you think she's doing based on what she just said now?
I would just be like, you can leave your past. Like,
so that's exactly right.
You
see, yeah, you're coming out shining, Rebecca.
Oh, really? Because I feel extremely nervous, that's, like I had to do about
okay.
that C-section.
I don't care if you're nervous. That's fine. Just tells me that you're normal. But you're coming out shining. You're in charge. You're in control. You're taking over, you're directing under extremely adverse circumstances. This is exactly what they're looking for. And you're checking all the hypothetical boxes in the examiner's mind. And like Nazan said, okay, you can go home now. You're done. We're good. Okay? So you're presenting very, very well. Just by the way,
can I tell you what can I finish answering your question just real quick? So I packed her, and I had the other nurse. I packed her with the packs I knew I had, because I had run this simulation. I had forced the nurses.
What did you pack? What did you pack?
I packed her with abdominal laps. Her that mom's abdomen open. I packed until I could pack no more.
Jesus!
And I had to
now you've just opened up a can of worms. You've opened
Why?
Up a can of worms. You're doing a C-section under local, and you're packing the abdomen.
No,
she
not the abdomen. I mean, I packed over the hysterotomy. No, she had a great epidural. She had a great epidural,
Was she a C-section? Did she have a local anesthetic or epidural?
No, she was in laboring induction with an epidural in place.
So I think
we were fully
Maybe
dilated.
Maybe I was with another patient. Okay. Sorry. So
yeah.
She had an epidural. I retract everything I said regarding C-section under local, except that all of you do need to know it, because it is important. But it's not relevant to this case. I apologize.
My cart is loaded with 50 cc's of lidocaine and all the stuff to do that as well. The cart that I made them grab.
Good. Look, the take-home message for everyone that's listening in. I'm going to get into the nitty-gritty with Rebecca on a one-on-one. But this is a classical case, and it's relevant for everyone to hear this. This is a classical case because it's a nightmare of a case in practice.
Yes, yes.
And so many things can go, I'm sure. So many things can go wrong and did go wrong, and the baby was flat. And there's oftentimes no exactly perfect right answer. And, for example, I posed a question to you. How did you strategize yourself regarding management of both mom and the baby at the same time? And you could have answered that a lot of different ways. And all of them would have been okay, provided what you were saying was reasonable. That's the point I want to make drive home. There's no one answer here. You can say a whole host of different things. As long as it sounds reasonable, you're fine. And I want to tell you, I think that this case is absolutely fine. And I will just briefly share with you how you can present it. Because a lot of you listening in may have more detailed cases, and I just want to give you an example of how you can present a very complicated case very briefly. I would say that this was a 32-year-old post-age induction who labored well, but in the second stage had a failed vacuum. I had to do an emergency C-section under epidural, and the baby did not do well. I was in a situation where I'm in a very rural practice. I had to take care of both the mother intra-op and resuscitate the baby. Fortunately, the baby did well. I don't have the most recent activity, but I understand it is meeting its milestones, and the mother did well as well. I'd obviously be happy to discuss any of the issues in further detail that you're interested in, and leave it like that.
Yeah.
I think I did it in less than 30 seconds, and that would be a totally appropriate way to present a real detailed case. Just give the superficial bare minimum, and in that bare minimum, be sure to mention those issues that you want to talk about, okay? Because if you don't mention them there, you're not going to get a further discussion on it. So does that make
Will
sense
they be,
to you, Rebecca?
Yes, it does. It does, and one thing I've thought about with this, because it does make me nervous, but I also am very proud of this case because I would like to highlight the fact that doctors that work in rural medicine can be prepared and do very difficult things if you prepare yourself and your team for it, because this is something that happened suddenly in the middle of the night.
You know, the one thing I realized about this case is, as frightening as it was, the thing that I think really saved the day was that because I'm in a rural area, I'd gone through these kind of potential possibilities in my head, so I wasn't confronting it for the first time. I'd given it some thought before, so I think that made it. You can say that, and it shows you're being proactive, and you come across very, very well. So, great case. Not so much so in practice, but for the exam, a wonderful case.
Thank you.
All righty. You've got a sure thing. Let's go to Nazanin, and then we'll come back to your second case, okay?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Nazanin, you're out there with a very brief case. Go ahead and present it, and we'll chat.
Sounds good. So my patient is a 16-year-old G0P0 who presented to the ED with acute abdomen and transvaginal ultrasound showed a 9-centimeter right simple neck full mass. And based on her symptoms, she has a suspected ovarian torsion. She was kept for observation with pain medication overnight. And in the morning, when I arrived there, I offered her laparoscopic diagnostic laparoscopy and also laparoscopic right self-endarterectomy. Surgical paths show the ovary with parenchymal hemorrhage, edema, and also necrosis. And she had a benign right fallopian tube with seven centimeter paratubal cyst. There was no complication, and she went home the same day.
My question to you is, I've got one specific issue I'm going to bring up, but my question is, what's your concern here? That she's a 16-year-old that lost her tube and ovary? Is that it?
Yes.
Okay.
I cringe looking at this, but the thing is, I cringe looking at this. I would totally judge anybody who had this on their caselet and want to know more. But, I know they came out with a committee opinion about, adnexal masses and adnexal torsion or whatever it was in
adolescence.
They were like, so they were like, just
and what's the bottom line of that committee opinion?
Basically,
can you recall?
It's a committee opinion, right? It's like,
yes.
Depends
from about
on
4 years ago, yeah?
Yeah, so it was like, leave it alone, it'll go back, it restores its blood supply.
So I'm going to correct you just slightly.
Okay.
In a nutshell, my reading of that committee opinion is,
mm-hmm.
and its title is Adnexal Torsion in Adolescence. This is a committee opinion from about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
What they say is, and this is where we've got to discuss further, you should be quick
mm-hmm.
to take the patient to the OR. But
mm-hmm.
once you're in the OR, you should be ultra conservative and just untwist and
mm-hmm.
observe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the committee opinion in a nutshell. Quick
mm-hmm.
to take her to the OR, but then hands off and don't remove.
Mm-hmm.
Yours, as you presented it, was somewhat the exact opposite.
I can argue
with you that you were
mm-hmm.
slow to take her to the OR, you watched her overnight, and then you had to remove it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just by the way, the decision to remove it, I have no problem with, because number one, it was 9 centimeters, I think you said, on ultrasound, 7 centimeters on pathology. There was hemorrhage and focal necrosis, which suggests
mm-hmm.
that it wasn't viable. And you can
mm-hmm.
add that visually you could see this was non-viable. And when you untwisted,
mm-hmm.
you can say visually it didn't pink up, okay?
Yeah.
So it was a compromise, and at that point, you had to remove it. You're comfortable with that so far?
Yeah, so I wanted to clarify. So this was when I came on to the call in the morning. So the decision to keep her overnight and observe wasn't mine.
That's an important bit of information to add.
Okay.
I don't want you to throw your partner under the bus. Don't be critical. But say, ideally, this patient should have been taken, in my opinion, to the OR the night before. You can say, I think the reason why this didn't happen was that the patient, despite appropriate counseling, declined that option but agreed to overnight
mm-hmm.
admission. And she didn't. She deteriorated overnight. I think you can say that that's probably pretty close to the truth. But you need to. It's really important that you get across to the examiner that ideally
mm-hmm.
this
yeah.
patient should have gone to the OR the night before. It might have made the difference of saving the adnexa.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you admit that it should have gone the night before. You've got to come up with a reason why she didn't. In your case,
mm-hmm.
it's easy. Someone else was making the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But even if it was your decision, you can always defend
mm-hmm.
it by saying, following counseling, the patient declined. And then they would ask you, how did you counsel her? You know, so this is easy to defend. And I don't see it as a problem at all, to be quite honest. Did I answer your question or not yet?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I just wanted, wasn't sure how do I, like, yeah, because then you don't want to, like, kind of berate your colleagues at the same time.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you say, I've got the utmost respect for my colleague, and I've no doubt he or she would have recommended OR the previous night, but I understand the patient declined.
Mm-hmm.
It's the easiest thing to say it that way. I also, as a general principle, what I want to share with all of you, this applies to all of you. When you've got something that you feel bad about in a particular case, in this instance, she's a 16-year-old who lost her one ovary, take the bull by the horns. And when they ask you to present the case, you say, you know, this is a very unfortunate case, because you'll notice this was a 16-year-old who landed up losing her one ovary. The reasons behind this were as follows, and then you go on to present the case. But you, up front, you lay it all out. You tell the examiner, this was a tough case for the following reason. And Rebecca's case, she might say, you know, this was a very tough case because we almost lost the baby. And what transpired was ABC. You can say that. And you're... Just by the way, this was an upsetting case because whatever follows next should include that issue, that topic that you want to talk about, because that you're laying the stage for the conversation in your opening statement. So, Nazanin, are you comfortable with that?
Yeah. Sounds good.
Okay. Excellent. All right. Very good. I'm pleased. Nice case. All right. Rebecca,
Dr. Shamrock, can I offer one thing to Nazreen, just from my experience?
Yes.
So when you present it, just throw in there before they even ask you about the length of time that you would observe it if you did untwist it, and then you can say that it was non-viable and you had to remove it, and that it just says that you thought about that ahead of time. You know, once you're in the OR.
Yes. Let me clarify one thing that you said, which I think is a good point, and it's a point for everyone listening in. If any of you are in a situation where you disagree with any management that was done, you must be comfortable to discuss how you would have managed it differently. In this case, Nazanin, you know, you would have gone in a little earlier. Whatever the difference is, be comfortable to discuss how you would have managed and why that is better. Okay? So thanks for adding that part, Rebecca.
Yeah.
Alrighty.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Rebecca, we come to a very, very tough case for you, no doubt. Go ahead.
Yes.
Same thing as I mentioned before. Present it as succinctly as you can, and then we'll talk about it.
Okay. I will try very hard. This is an 18-year-old G1 who was term, 39 weeks, who showed up in labor with rupture of membranes and thin meconium. She was not my patient. She was a patient from about an hour and a half away in the city. And she went from four centimeters to complete in less than an hour, had a normal spontaneous vaginal delivery at approximately 1 a.m. She did have a cord avulsion, which was later explained by the pathology of the placenta with a marginal insertion. The placenta was manually extracted.
Stop for a second. Rebecca, hold on. I mean, everyone listening in doesn't know where we're going yet with this story.
Oh, yes.
But you do. Do you think the cord avulsion is relevant to the big picture here?
No. Not at all.
So don't mention it. It's really you've got so much more interesting stuff. This is you can say, you know, there are other issues involved, but this was the bulk of what I've just mentioned was the bulk of the issues. So, you know, you don't want to be dishonest.
Let me start. Give me a second chance. Okay. This is an 18-year-old G1 at 39 weeks who presented to my labor and delivery unit with ruptured membranes and thin meconiums. She was a patient unknown to me, a patient of someone in the city. She progressed from four to complete in less than an hour and had an uncomplicated vaginal delivery. At that point, at 7 a.m. that morning, I passed her off to my locum physician, and she had 34 hours of uncomplicated postpartum care and clinical status, both vitals and labs normal. At 34 hours postpartum, she complained of a painful abdominal abdominal distension and pain. The nurse came in and noted approximately 100 cc blood clot in the bed. They called the physician. At that time, he ran preeclampsia labs because she had a blood pressure in the 140s. Those labs demonstrated a white count of 2.2, platelets of 40, and a fibrinogen in the 50s. And at that point, he thought it was preeclampsia with HELLP syndrome. He presented to the bedside, and within about a 30-minute course, she quickly decompensated and was transferred to the ICU, intubated, a mass transfusion, and DIC protocol was initiated. He felt that she may have an amniotic fluid embolism with DIC. The head of the ER, the head of the intensivist ICU, and the OB on call was at the bedside. And despite all efforts and following normal protocols for these reasonable clinical assessments, the 18-year-old expired at approximately 2 hours and 20 minutes after her first complaint. Afterwards, about 7 hours later, group A strep pyogenes grew out in her blood cultures. And after...
It's not pyogenes, it's pyogenes. It's pyogenes. Just pronounce it.
Pyogenes.
Pyogenes, not pyogenes.
Pyogenes, okay.
I've
never encountered it. This is one of those CDC rare reportable diseases. So the death is what is suspected to be caused by group A strep pyogenes, toxic shock syndrome with sepsis, cardiovascular collapse, DIC, ARDS by chest x-ray, and looking in the literature, she would have had to have been colonized and already on this pathway prior to presenting in labor. By the way, she presented with a normal white count, no fever, normal labs with me, never mounted a fever. And at this point, I will tell you, Dr. Shamrock, this is where I get flustered with myself because I usually am concise because I don't even know how detailed. I mean, I know this case in and out. I can explain endotoxin A, what happened, how this is a rare, you know, OB issue, but I don't know what to say after that.
You don't have to say anything. Let me show you how I would present this. If they ask you to go and present the case, I'd say this was a most tragic case. You'll notice at the end, an 18-year-old woman died 36 hours postpartum. What transpired was a normal labor, normal delivery, but 36 hours postpartum, she developed pretty much out of the blue an acute abdomen or an acute abdominal pain. She presented with bleeding vaginally, and within a space of 90 minutes, she decompensated. Labs showed possible preeclampsia with HELLP syndrome, and it soon became evident she was in frank DIC. I was concerned as part of the differential that there was respiratory distress, there was DIC, there might have been a fluid amniotic fluid embolus, possible DVT. Go through the list the things in your differential that you were thinking about. Despite the assistance of all the physicians I could muster and the appropriate coagulopathy, coagulation management and blood component therapy, she passed away within two hours of her initial presentation. She was subsequently found to have strep A pyogenes, which I've since read up is known to present this way. In fact, we had to report to CDC. That's it. Let the examiner then decide where they want to go in this conversation. And I'll tell you where it's going to go. The fact that everyone listening can understand why I interrupted you early on. You've all heard the presentation. In this maternal death, the fact that there was an avulsion, cord avulsion and marginal insertion is of no consequence. And it just wastes time and muddies the water. You want to keep it as focused as possible. So where the conversation is going to go is the following. The differential diagnosis of cardiorespiratory collapse, you need to know that very well. And specifically, I'm guessing it landed up being this group A strep pyogenes, but I'm guessing the amniotic fluid embolus must have been high on the list. Am I correct?
Yes. Remember, I
could be wrong because
I passed it off to one of my colleagues, but I've reviewed the case, and I believe he did everything right. And he actually wrote in his note immediately following this that he thought it was DIC and amniotic fluid embolism, and that it wasn't until the cultures came back and we, went through everything that we found out that it followed a very specific pattern of quick decompensation associated with this bacteria.
It sounds like he followed a textbook pattern.
Yeah,
she was textbook this woman.
80% mortality that died quickly.
You need to say that. In fact, I've read up on this since she was a textbook description. You say,
yeah,
and there's an 80% mortality. You say that. The point that I want you to make is, as you and folks, this technique that I'm sharing now with Rebecca is relevant for everyone. And I want you all, as you're describing your management in any given situation, think aloud. So, Rebecca, you might say, when I was presented with the increasing multi-organ failure, the things that I was thinking of was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. With respect to amniotic fluid embolus, which was very high on the list, in fact, was probably my number one concern, in favor of that diagnosis was the fact that there was evidence of DRC and she was in shock. Against that was the fact that this was 36 hours out. You'd expect it to occur much more sooner postpartum. You'd expect it in patients with twins with Pitocin augmentation induction. So it was still a possibility, but I had to work out in favor versus not in favor. Overall, I thought it was a real possibility. The next one, and I was surprised in the end where she cultured out group A strep pyogenes, which turned out to be the ultimate cause. How does that approach sound to you, Rebecca?
It sounds good. Two questions I have is that, do I even mention that there was, a handoff of physicians? Because They did call me when this was happening, and I was, there was a locum there, but, I was on the phone with them. I do feel like everything was done correctly, and I do feel like...
So say that. When you compliment another physician, you're coming across as very confident. It's the unconfident, insecure person who always says, they don't know what they're doing, listen to me. When you come across and say, I wasn't the one involved in the initial management, but I got to tell you, I think all the decisions that were made were correct.
Mm-hmm.
You're passing your opinion. That's absolutely fine. And you come across as shining. You really do. So, look, this is a conversation, in my view, on amniotic fluid embolus, which they love, DIC, and now I'm going to say mass transfusion management. You folks don't need to know mass transfusion because that's really the domain of ICU and hematology. But you do need to know when, under what circumstances you would order FFP versus cryoprecipitate, platelets versus whole blood. How many would you order? How many units of packed red blood cells would you order at a time, based on the hematocrit of X? And how much fluid would you give with this versus with that? You've got to understand the basic principles behind blood component therapy. And again, by the way, when you come to our definitive board prep course, we're going to spend about an hour and a half on postpartum hemorrhage. So it's probably the most commonly asked question in any OBGYN board is that. And as part of that discussion, we're going to go through blood component therapy. So we've got you folks covered. But coming back to this case, I want you folks all to realize where a conversation can go. So I think it's mostly on amniotic fluid embolus. It's also on DIC. It's also on, which it turned out to be, septic shock. Okay? And cardiorespiratory, mostly respiratory, the differential for cardiorespiratory or respiratory collapse, or the differential diagnosis of dyspnea. And that's where the DVT and PE come in. So that's where this conversation is going. And folks, with all these kind of cases, especially the severe ones, you know, I need to emphasize, and I think all of you listening in are going to agree with me, these two cases that Rebecca had, they were real tragic cases. These patients had the results that they had, not because of Rebecca, but despite Rebecca. And that phrase is one that I think you folks, I encourage you to use if you feel it genuinely fits. You say in the exam, you know, in retrospect, I've looked at this case from every possible angle, as you can understand. And I have to be honest, I think this case, this complication occurred despite my best efforts, not because of my actions. Or alternatively, you can say, I've looked at this case from every possible angle, and I've come to the conclusion that, and what I'm going to say now, folks, very powerful. I strongly encourage you to use this in your armamentarium of responses in the exam. You say, you know, if I was confronted with this set of complications exactly the same again tomorrow, even though I had a bad outcome, I think I would be forced to do exactly the same thing. Remember, especially in OB, but also in general surgery and medicine in general, doing the right thing doesn't guarantee a good outcome. There are going to be patients who don't make it, who have complications, regardless of what we do. We're not God. We can't cure everything. So be comfortable to say that in the exam. If I was presented with the same situation again, I would do it exactly the same. So, that's Rebecca, are you comfortable with that? Do you have any other follow-up questions?
Well, you're absolutely right. I would do the same thing, and I would recommend the same thing. It's just such a tragic, you know, outcome.
Yeah, so that's why you say it up front. It was a real tragic outcome. I lost the patient. You say
I can't
that.
Think
don't,
of I just was trying to make sure that no one else could think of anything else that I could have done differently because I can't.
You did the right thing.
Okay.
You did the right thing. There's something else I want to say. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I'm a nice, likable guy, and I play the role of the mock oral examiner, not the real oral examiner. I'm not a tough guy. Unless if a person asks me to be tough, I can be tough. But even with me being a nice, likable guy in this environment, I get a candidate who, from time to time, is presenting a very tragic case. And as the candidate is presenting the case, I see it's typically a woman, and I'm not trying to be sexist, but I would say women are more sensitive in this department.
Mm-hmm.
I see the woman, the candidate, tearing up.
And I was going to actually ask you that. Is that okay? Because I have teared up.
Yeah, that's why I'm bringing this up.
Case.
Yeah, this is exactly why I'm bringing it up for you, Rebecca, but also everyone listening in. I don't want the situation to be they ask you, oh, hi, where are you practicing, and you break into tears. That's inappropriate.
Right, right.
If you've got a patient who's died and you feel your eyes welling up, You can say in the exam, take a tissue with you. I'm being serious. You pull up the tissue, wipe your eyes, and say, I apologize. This case really got to me emotionally. I'm sorry. And then you carry on. What you're showing your examiner is that you take your work seriously and your patients are very important to you and you're sensitive. What more can an examiner ask? So I don't want you to feel, if I show that I'm crying, I'm going to fail the exam. Not at all. That doesn't mean to say, look for an excuse to cry. I'm not saying that. But if any of you have a case like we've got here, and you feel yourself being overcome by emotion, it can happen. Okay? I will share with you a passing note, interest only. Last week, I had to put my cat down. I went with my daughter. And when I came to the realization it was going to happen then, I started welling up in front of my daughter. It was tough. But, you know, it shows a sensitivity. And my daughter appreciated it. She told me that afterwards. So the cats are not the same as humans, obviously. But the point that I'm making is it's okay. This is you. It's yourself. You're showing yourself. And it comes across very well. So, Rebecca, are you okay with this case, or any other questions you got on it?
I think so. I just need to practice to present it in a concise way that leads them where I want them to go.
Yes. Now, folks, one more comment. We need to start tying this down. When you've got cases like this, you really need to practice talking about them. And if you can practice in an environment that mimics that of the exam, in other words, high pressure, potentially hostile, that's fantastic. But you need to be comfortable to A, present the case, and then to discuss the case. Those are two separate things. And the more you can practice, the more smooth you're going to be in the exam. So, you know, when you've got cases like this, I tell candidates, ask people to grill you on these specific cases.
Mm-hmm.
So that by the time you come to the exam, you've had the conversations of any question that the examiner can ask you. You're not hearing it for the first time. And you'll present much, much better in the exam.
Right.
So, yes, practice as much as you can.
Can I ask two quickly? Number one, should I mention that I feel strongly that even if this case had happened in a big academic center, the outcome would be the same versus my rural setting. I feel like there was nothing that would have been done differently despite what hospital she was in.
I think that's absolutely fine. You know,
okay.
I would say, based on my subsequent reading, I mean, obviously I was very compromised being in a rural setting. But based on my reading and understanding of this disease, I do think with an 80% mortality rate, even if this had occurred in a tertiary university hospital, I still think the odds for this patient surviving were not good. And leave it at
correct.
That.
Okay.
Which is legitimate.
Okay. And
it's true. It's open
yeah,
and honest.
Absolutely. And then the second question is, should I even mention, so the pediatrician was kind of aloof, let the baby go that day the mom died. I subsequently made phone calls, and then I had to call a sister and an aunt to basically beg as I'm crying on the phone saying, you've got to get this baby to Driscoll, to the NICU, needs antibiotics. Sure enough, when the baby got there, it was also colonized, but they were able to get antibiotics on board and prevent the exact same thing that happened to mom happening to baby because we caught it in time. But
so,
it took a lot of effort to get the baby there.
So look, you know, if the examiner asks you that, that's now pediatrics. It's not obstetrics.
Mm-hmm.
If the examiner has a curiosity, let he or she ask you that, and then you can
okay.
respond.
Yeah, because I kind of had to intervene
I mean,
there.
To mention that up front.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Okay, all right. So great cases, Rebecca, very nice. Folks, before we end, I will just tell you the next teleseminar will be on the 2 weeks from today, the 14th of July. I'm going to end off, by the way, the same way I started. Folks, your case list represents 50% of the exam. I implore you, more important, if I had to choose one between, if you could only come to one course, the cases construction course or the definitive board prep course, I would say the cases construction course comes first. It's only one day, and it's really sets you up superbly well. And even if you listen to it now, you've still got 4 weeks, 5 weeks before the deadline for submission. So I'm pretty sure virtually every single one of you have already watched that. And that's the first best, and then the definitive board prep course thereafter. Obviously, those of you who already attended, I'm sure you're very pleased that you did. But those who haven't, I will be seeing you in Baltimore or Los Angeles. The first one, I think, is in Baltimore at the end of the third or fourth week of August. No, of July. Of July. So, folks, that's it. We'll do this again in 2 weeks' time. And I want to thank, first, let me ask Rebecca Nazanin. Rebecca, the honest truth, what was it like being on the hot seat? Be honest.
Nerve-wracking, but reassuring.
Okay. Are you pleased that you did it?
I am. Good. I was very nervous, but I'm
okay.
Pleased.
Yeah, that's exactly normal. That's exactly normal. Nazanin, are you still there? Hello, Nazanin? I think we may have lost Nazanin. Okay. Folks, listen, thank you so much for joining us. If any of you have any questions, please get in touch. I'll be happy to oblige as best as I can. And Rebecca, you'll get in touch with me, and we'll discuss your case further in more detail on a one-on-one basis. Folks,
I appreciate that.
Thank you so much, everyone, and we'll see you. You're welcome, and we'll see you all in 2 weeks' time. All the best, folks. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.